This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hello, everybody. It's the Hockey News Podcast here. Well, sort of. It's Matt Larkin. I'm at home because I am snowed in. There's snow everywhere. No one can get to the office. And I do have Ken Campbell on the phone with me. Ryan Kennedy is pretty sick. His voice sounds even deeper than normal, so deep that it's not podcast friendly. But I do have Ken here on the phone, on speaker. Hey, Kenny boy, how you doing?
Yeah, long time listener, first time caller. Glad I was able to get on the phone with you.
Hey, anytime. Anytime. It's my pleasure.
We called the Army in to help us clear out the snow again, like we did back in 1999.
Yeah, that's how Toronto treats snow. Like, Ken's from Sudbury and I'm from Ottawa, so for us,
yeah,
this is pretty normal, but
for us, this is Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. But people are like, there's a bus stuck in the middle of the road. Like, people just don't know what to do. It's just, it's chaos. But we still wanted to bring you at least a miniature podcast because there is plenty to talk about. And first of all, we've got to talk about Jake Muzzin, of course, the Toronto Maple Leafs making the first big move of trade season coming out of the All-Star break. They get Jake Muzzin. They give up two, in my opinion, two of their top six prospects, defenseman Sean Durzi and left winger Carl Grundstrom, and also first rounder in 2019. And to me, I'm looking at this trade, Kenny, and it just seems to make so much sense. It's just very logical from both sides. I mean, it looks like the Kings, they've actually nicely stocked what's a pretty weak farm system. I like Grundstrom and I like Durzi. And the Leafs, I get it too, right? They get an extra year, so it's not really a rental, an extra year of Muzzin, and they make the blue line stronger. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think this is one of those really good trade deadline trades. You know, the seller gets better in the long term and the buyer gets better in the short term. And, you know, like you said, I mean, what I like about it from the Leafs' perspective is they didn't give up anything off the roster to get a guy that, you know, could slide in and be a really good addition for their blue line. I mean, Muzzin has played the left side the better part of his career, and the best hockey he played was on the left side with Drew Doughty, obviously. But he can play the right side and probably will in Toronto. He'll almost certainly play with Morgan Rielly, and then that moves both Zaitsev and Hainsey down a bit on the depth chart and maybe gives them a little less responsibility, which is probably a good thing. And a good thing for the Leafs, too, is they've got a guy coming in at $4 million next year. And, you know, Jake Gardner's making 4.5. He's not going to be making that next year, whether it's in Toronto or somewhere else, and it almost certainly will be somewhere else. So they've got a bit of insurance that way, too. So, a good move for a cup, for a team that's you know, trying to put something together for a cup run here. And, you know, from the Kings side of things, Carl Grundstrom is probably going to be a really good, serviceable third-line player for a long time. And Durzi will be a decent defenseman for them. And the first-round pick will be whatever they can get for, you know, I mean, if the Leafs make the final, then it's a 30th or 31st pick. If not, it's probably somewhere in the late 20s. So to go along with what they hope, I'm sure, will be the first pick overall, and Jack Hughes. So I think it helps both teams in their objectives. You know, the Leafs were trying to get better in the short term and shore up their defense, and the Kings were obviously, you know, looking to the future on this one.
Exactly. I agree. And what I'm curious about is I agree that it looks like Muzzin or Rielly, I think one of the two of them is going to play the right side. And I do think they're going to be paired together to form sort of a super pairing because both guys have played the right side in spurts before. But what I'm wondering now is whether Dubas is done. So he was talking to the media sort of implying that, okay, we've got our bye and we're going to give all the defensemen time. We're going to evaluate all of them on the right side and make a decision. That sounds like someone who is done upgrading his blue line, but I'm still skeptical about that. I wouldn't be surprised if there's another move up his sleeve to get an actual right shot. But what I'm also wondering is, so this trade basically put the nail in Jake Gardner's coffin as a Leaf. I think that's pretty clear because Muzzin, now they have basically a cheaper Gardner for next season. But what I wonder is, do you explore trading Gardner for something before the deadline, or do you treat him like a rental that you need, or do you look to see if there's a team that might want him and you can maybe get a right shot defenseman coming back your way in a hockey trade? Or is that not realistic? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I mean, but I do know that, you know, I think the Leafs value Jake Gardner a lot more than their fan base does. I think Mike Babcock appreciates him a lot more than, you know, than the Boobers do. And I think the organization sees a lot more value in him than a lot of other people. So I think they really like him. I think they know that if they want to contend for a playoff spot, they've got to be very deep at defense. So I'm not sure that you make a move involving Jake Gardner, but now do they go out and go after Wayne Simmons or Michael Ferland up front to give them a bit of edge in the playoffs, to give them that kind of player that can play against, a team like Boston, who they're probably going to face in the first round. I still think they need a right shot defense that can really stabilize things back there. I still think they have the assets to go out and get a big name like an Alex Pietrangelo. St. Louis is 3 points out of the playoffs right now. They've got four or five teams between them and the playoffs. There's still 4 weeks to go to the deadline. There's still a lot to be shaken out here, but, if St. Louis is out of it at the deadline, then, do you take a run at a Pietrangelo? I say you do. The price might be too high. You may not be able to fit him under your cap. A lot of other factors that way, too.
It's true. I'm still with you. I think that the Leafs have their most flexibility right now to take their shot. So if I'm them, I would be still kicking the tires on Dougie Hamilton or Alex Pietrangelo. And it would require a major package, which probably means sacrificing a Kasperi Kapanen or an Andreas Janssen and or a Timothy Liljegren. But I still think they're in their best window, especially this year, before they have Marner and Matthews contracts on the books. So I'd be tempted to do it too. I think it's more realistic to expect maybe pursuing, like you said, that banging winger like Wayne Simmons. And maybe I could see a scenario where they make a deal for Wayne Simmons and Radko Gudas, something with the Flyers, where they get two pieces and maybe it still costs less than what it would acquire to get a big fish like a Pietrangelo. So it's going to be interesting to see. But I think I don't think anyone doubts that they've upgraded. And Muzzin's actually having a great year. He doesn't play with Drew Doughty nearly as much anymore. Yeah, but I agree. He's been very good. So we'll see. We'll see how he does under the bright lights, but he is a Stanley Cup champion.
And you mentioned the bright lights, and I think that's an interesting observation, because he hasn't been under the bright lights. He's played in LA. It's a big city, a big market, but it's not a big hockey market, and it's not one where every move that a player makes is critiqued and dissected, and that's going to happen here. And some players react well to that. Some players love it, actually. Gary Roberts used to love it. He hated it in Florida because nobody cared about hockey. He wanted to come back and play in a place where people really, really cared about the game. And, some guys react really well to that. Some guys, it doesn't bother them at all, doesn't make a difference. And some guys, they don't react well to it. So it'll be interesting to see how Jake Muzzin handles all of that. I mean, it'll be great at the beginning because things will be going great. But, there's going to be some rough spots, and we'll see how they all handle that.
For sure. And the other thought I had was for Muzzin, the silver lining for him is that he's not going to be expected to be the guy, because this team has so many big personalities, big stars, that maybe he can blend in. That's sort of his game. It's to be well-rounded, to be sort of a B-plus in every category and not really stand out. So we'll see. Maybe he'll be a good fit. So Ken and I just got back from San Jose, the All-Star weekend. Ken's favorite weekend in hockey. He can't get enough of the action when it's out there. But it was interesting because, as you all know, the women stole the event. Brianna Decker and Kendall Coyne Schofield, and even Ryan and I were covering the stories on the Night of the Skills competition, and we sort of spoke after. We said, we know this is an NHL event and that's sort of our assignment, but we got to roll with what's really happening here. So Ryan went and interviewed Kendall. I went and interviewed Brianna, because we just thought, this is the moment. This is the right story to tell. And I think it's the story a lot of people have been talking about, and we know now that CCM gave $25,000 to Brianna Decker, and the NHL did its own thing with $25,000 in each of the women's name to their charity of choice. But what I want to talk about now with you, Kenny, is what it means going forward for the All-Star Weekend, and is it possible now, given I think how much Decker and Schofield in particular opened people's eyes, is it possible that we could see them added to or women in general, added to the All-Star game, maybe one per division, and allowed to compete in the 3-on-3 tournament?
Well, I think that would be the natural progression here. You know, it obviously was a huge hit. And, you know, I mean, the NHL, I mean, sometimes they just stumble into these things. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, the John Scott thing, and it was a disaster until it wasn't. And then it was, and it ended up being the great story of the All-Star game. I think this, I think they thought it might be a nice little novelty. I don't think anybody expected that, you know, that Kendall Schofield was going to, you know, be right there with the best players in the NHL in the skating competition. So yeah, I mean, I you know, I mean, this is a game that's you know, really not. It doesn't move the needle anyway, in any way, shape, or form. So I don't see why not. And you know what? If I were the NHL, I would be like, forget about last man in. How about last woman in or something? You know, maybe have that last spot for, you know, people to nominate women hockey players that can play in this thing.
Yeah, I agree all the way, especially when you look, if anyone tries to claim, oh, that would be a novelty, it's like, yeah, that's the whole point of the weekend. This is the same event in which someone picked up Johnny Gaudreau and used him as a child. Brent Burns wore a Chewbacca mask. Brent Burns used his own son. Patrick Kane wore a Superman cape. Ovechkin used two sticks. Oh, no, we're not going to let women play in this tournament. That would be too weird, right? It's like, yeah, come on. I think it'd be a great idea. And if John Scott can get in, Kendall Coyne can skate circles around John Scott. And if John Scott can hang with those players in a tournament where no one's playing their most physical game, I think absolutely a Kendall Coyne or whoever the qualified player is next year deserves a chance. And I think it would be a lot of fun. And it would generate a lot of interest. I bet you there'd be higher ratings. As I said on Twitter this week, our most read stories, our most popular stories of the entire week were the stories on Coyne and Decker. So there would be an audience for this. I think people would tune in and it would be a lot of fun.
I think you're right. I mean, you'd be opening it up to an entirely, you know, different demographic if you had more women involved in it. You know, they're obviously, you know, in a situation like this, they can play. I mean, they could, you know, in a game where, you know, it's not a physical game, where it's more based on skill and speed, and you know, I can see Kendall Coyne being able to hang with, you know, those guys in a game like that. You know, she'd probably provide a lot of exposure for the women's game and a lot of exposure for the NHL. And you know, I mean, there's obviously, you know, and obviously people, you know, like some of the sponsors in that are seeing this because, you know, Kendall Coyne and Renata Fast and Rebecca Johnson and Brianna Decker were all signed by Adidas recently. You know, Kendall Coyne was just announced today that Kendall Coyne's going to be an analyst for MSNBC NBC Sports coverage of the NHL. So,
awesome.
You know, I mean, obviously there's people that know that there's something good to be gleaned from all of this, and you know, it grows the game for the women, and I think it opens it up for the NHL to you know, to find some new audiences. So, you know, I think it's all good.
For sure. And I think what was really eye-opening, I mean, those of us who work in the industry, it's not like we didn't know who Kendall Coyne was, and we knew she was extremely fast. We noticed her especially at the Olympics last year. So I wasn't blown away by her being fast. But admittedly, I thought that her fast was going to be like 15 seconds. I didn't think she was going to be that fast. So it was still eye-opening for me as well. So what I'm wondering now is, especially with the way the men's game is trending, because it's becoming less physical year after year, are we getting closer to a universe in which we could see female players at higher levels? And, you know, whether it's, you know, are we 10, 20 years away from the AHL? And are we 20, 30 years away from a legitimate competitive NHL? I don't know. I think it's all in the realm of possibility now.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be that long, Matt. I don't think we're looking at 20 or 30 years. I think we're looking single digits here. You know, I was talking to Jennifer Botterill about this last night, because I thought that she'd be a good person to talk to, because she's played the game at a high level on the women's side, and she's an analyst for the New York Islanders, so she knows what the men's side looks like as well. And you know, she thinks it's close, not close, but she thinks it's, you know, it could be imminent. And you know, I look at someone like Haley Wickenheiser, when she was at her peak, when she was playing the best hockey of her career, I'm not sure she wouldn't have been able to maybe compete for a spot and play in a higher league like the Coast League or the American Hockey League now, or maybe even the NHL. Like, she's a lot bigger than a lot of these small guys that are you know, skating around now. She's certainly bigger than a guy like Johnny Gaudreau or whatever. And, you know, when she played, there was a lot more emphasis on the physical and the size, and now there's less. And I'm not sure that when she was at her best that she wouldn't have been able to, you know, to hang with NHL guys. So I think it's coming. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I think, you know, one of the things is shooting. I think one of the, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, women can shoot accurately, but I'm not sure that they can shoot hard enough to compete at the NHL level. But I think it's going to happen, and I don't think it's going to be, you know, 10 or 20 years. I think, you know, we're looking at maybe 5, 6, 7 years. There might be someone that comes up, you know, because the same way the men are getting better, like, we see kids coming into the league now that can do things that 18-year-old kids shouldn't be able to do. You know, I think the same way these kids are coming in and taking over the NHL. I mean, you know, girls, young girls and women are being trained by these same, you know, skills people, and they're getting just as good as well. So I would say they're going to probably lessen that gap a little bit.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Craig Button of TSN a few months ago. And we were talking about, in this case, we were talking about sort of the death of the traditional power forward. And what Button was saying was, you know, you're looking at generations of kids now that are coming into the NHL that when the new NHL arrived, post-lockout, 05, 06, these kids were only, you know, 4 or 5 years old, their formative years, so they were born into a less physical and more high-skill era. And then you get guys in the NHL like Austin Matthews, who's a big guy, but he's very, not hesitant, but it's almost like his brain isn't even wired to look for contact. He just doesn't think that way. He uses a stick. And I think we're seeing a generation of players that are going to keep coming into the league that sort of approach the game in a less physical way. So just by default, it's going to push a lot of the physicality out of the game. And I think that's going to open up and make the playing field more level for men and women to play on the same ice. So I'm with you. I think we're going to see it someday. It's tough to say what constitutes soon, but I think we're going to see it soon.
I think within the next decade is probably a good projection here. And as far as I'm concerned, I think within the next decade, we will see a woman who, you know, maybe can't play in the NHL, but might be able to, you know, compete for a spot.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you.
As a non-goal. I'm saying position player. Like, yeah. So I think as a position player, you know, within the next decade, there will be someone that knocks on that door.
All right, good. I'm going to hit you guys with some Fantasy Insider pickups, a few quick ones. I'm sure you've been paying attention to Nino Niederreiter in Carolina, getting a shot on that first line. He's already got two-goal games. It's sort of a no-brainer pickup. It's someone that we know has always had talent, but he's been struggling to escape that sort of middle six role in Minnesota. But we knew the ability was there, and he was a classic case of someone who needed a change of scenery, and he's immediately been given an opportunity. That's the kind of pickup when someone that you know has talent suddenly, as a result of a trade, finds himself in a favorable situation. He can be that's what I call a league winner, someone that you pick up off the wire late in your season that suddenly produces like a first-line player. So he's a priority pickup, absolutely, if you're in your playoff stretch run. A couple other guys to watch for, Frankie Vetrano in Florida. He's been really hot. It seems like he's scoring every night, and he's playing on that first line right now with Alexander Barkov and Evgeny Dodonov. And again, Vetrano is a little different from Niederreiter because Niederreiter is someone that always had the pedigree. Vetrano is a guy that sort of seems to be more of an overachiever, but he's getting an opportunity. He shoots the puck a lot, so if you're in a league that counts shots, he's a great pickup. He's someone that I would give a little bit less leash than I'd give to Niederreiter, but he's definitely a guy you want to grab if he's available. And the last one, I'm going to break my rule. Normally I say I'm only going to recommend guys who are available in at least 50% of leagues, but I would keep a close eye on Yaroslav Halak in Boston, even though he's owned in 66% of leagues, because Tuukka Rask, they're saying it's not long-term, but it's a concussion. You never know what a timeline is going to be with a concussion. And we saw earlier in the year, Yaroslav Halak was, for a while, playing as well as any goalie in the league when he was spelling Tuukka Rask when Rask took that lead from the team and was off to a slow start. So we know that Halak is capable on this team with this defense in front of him in Boston. He can be a top flight fantasy goaltender. So if the Rask owner in your league is a little bit slow and lazy and didn't replace Rask, that's someone you could swoop in and snag and could be a big difference maker. Maybe Rask is back next week and it's no big deal, but it's still worth stashing Halak to find out if you have the room on your bench. Kenny, we're going to close off this mini podcast with a hot take from you. So, what do you have?
Well, you know, Matt, you were in San Jose this weekend. I was in San Jose this weekend for the All-Star game, and there was a news conference, Gary Bettman's State of the Union on Friday, and there was a lot of kumbaya between the NHL and the NHL Players Association. There seems to be more optimism than ever that a labor disruption can be avoided. That's all well and good. They sat down a couple of times. They talked. They haven't really got into the meat of the issue. I think it's one thing to talk about canceling the 2020 World Cup. It's one thing to talk about putting the technology and the equipment so they can track players and pucks. That's one thing you can agree, you can come to an agreement on. I want to see where it goes when they start having the uncomfortable conversations about escrow and HRR and how much each side is going to want. Gary Bettman has come out and said we're not looking for a fight, and what that's code for actually is I think he's planting the seed that if something happens this time, it's going to be on the players because they're going to want takebacks. They're going to want it. They're going to be asking for something because in all the CBAs to this point, it's been, the owners wanting to change the system. Well, they've gotten all the changes they want. They got 50% revenues. The players were getting 57. They got their salary cap. They've got, term limits to a certain degree. They've gotten pretty much everything they want. So, the players have had their lunch money taken a few times and they've been beaten up a few times. And now it looks like they're going to be the ones looking for concessions. And so I'm sure the league's going to paint it. Well, these players are greedy and they're going to want take backs. The players are going to be saying, hey, look, we've given a lot to this business and business is moving right now. Record revenues, record profits, $650 million for an expansion franchise. We want a piece of that pie now too. So what I'm saying is, these guys right now are, like I said, it was all kumbaya. So, I think people need to hold their feet to the fire here. And it's like, okay, get this done then. If you guys are sitting here talking about how there's no tension in the room and how, everything, that the sides have this partnership and there's this renewed sort of sense of optimism, then you better follow through with that. And if we're going to miss a year of hockey or any hockey at all, it really looks like it'll be a situation where it's not necessary. So get it done, and don't come back to us, whining about how you can't get a deal done 9 months from now or 20 months from now or whatever it is.
I think you've nailed it, Ken. It really does seem to me like it's some PR strategy by the NHL sort of trying to set up the players as the bad guy because they know that on the NHL side, they're not looking for as many things this time, whereas Don Fear has said it repeatedly on the NHLPA side that they felt they made major concessions last time, and I do think that escrow might be the hill that they're going to want to die on, and of course, the expansion fee not being considered part of the hockey-related revenue pie going to the players, things like that. So the players, I think, do have some legit gripes, but it's pretty clever by the NHL that they're going to set things up so the players, if they have these gripes, are going to look a little bit selfish, whether that's fair or not. I don't think it is fair.
That's from pick one of the owner's, negotiation manual. That's make the players look like a bunch of greedy guys, right? I mean, you can sit there and go, Connor McDavid makes $12.5 million, A fourth line scrub makes $650,000. That's, 10 times more than most people make in a year, right? And so it's very easy to paint the picture that way, and I'm sure the NHL will go to that low-hanging fruit every single time, but the fact of the matter is that, the players have given some major, major concessions over the years. I mean, they've gone from 57% to 50% of revenues. I mean, that's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that the owners have made because of that, and, that's what's driven up franchise. revenues, and they're getting all the expansion revenues, and you know they're able to run their business in a way where they're able to make a lot of money if they do it right. So I think the players are going to come back and say we want some of that, and you know the NHL saying we're not looking for a fight and they don't want anything, but let's see what they say when the players say, well, we want to go to the Olympics every year, or we want to do something about escrow. You know, then we'll see how. Then that's where the rubber hits the road, and you wonder how ugly it's going to get.
That's right. And one thing I've never understood is there's sort of, in the court of public opinion, I find a blue-collar stance that the players are the greedy ones. And to me, it always blows my mind because it's like the players are the millionaires. The owners are the billionaires. So people sort of treat the players like they're these greedy fat cats. But I'm like, relative to the owners, the players make no money. So it's strange. I always find that seems to be often a public perception, at least among a certain group. But that's just the way it is, and I think the NHL knows that.
Yeah, and I think people don't realize. I mean, not anybody can own a hockey team, but everybody, you know, all these people that think the owners or the players are greedy maybe have all played hockey at a certain point in their life, and they might think that they would do it for $100,000 a year, or they would do it for, you know, for nothing, or, you know, that these players are being greedy. But what they don't realize is that, you know, these players are the best in the world at what they do. They've made enormous sacrifices to get where they are, and they have a very finite amount of time in which to make the earnings that are going to last them the rest of their lives, you know? And, you know, I mean, I don't begrudge the players whatever they make. I mean, they're paid. They're not overpaid. They're not underpaid. They're paid what they're worth. And, you know, I mean, it's funny how everybody says, you know, that they would play for a lot less, or they would, you know, they'd do this and that. But, you know, I mean, once you get there and once you're in that environment, you realize you're the best in the world at what you do, and somebody's making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars off of what you're doing, well, then, you know, the rules change a little bit.
That's right. I agree all the way. Well, everybody, that's it for this mini podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it sounded okay from my little workstation at home. And we'll be back next week, hopefully with some regular sound quality and 100% more Ryan Kennedy.